Please put your hands together for Justin Rimmel, Shane Waters.
Hope you guys are ready for some true crime and suspicious deaths tonight. Alright, before we get started, I was going to read some one-star reviews, but I haven't actually gotten any for a while, so I don't get to get savage on anybody. So, first of all, I'd like to introduce Shane. For those of you who don't know, we are business partners at ACC Productions. We run a bunch of podcasts together. He's from Out of the Shadows podcast and American Crime Cast, so then, obviously, I'd like to thank Jerry and Tracy, Rob and Dick, for inviting me to tag along and have a good time here tonight. So I hope everybody's having fun.
Yeah!
Yeah! Hey, guys! So Justin will hush up. I'll talk for a second. First off, like, how short are you people? Like, seriously, like, this is crazy. Can you guys hear me? Like, the weather's pretty fresh, actually. So I'm from Out of the Shadows, previously American Crime Cast. But I wanted to touch on, just for a quick moment before we get into some true crime, about the Hillbilly Horror Story. So if you're out there, not here, you should go back and listen to their episode because they were talking about a really cool haunting. So before we get started, Justin has no idea that we're going to talk about this. He's very nervous. Can everyone give him a hand, please? He made it all the way out here. How many beers have you had, Justin? 12, 13. So, Justin here talked me in one day to going into Hartford City, Indiana to go to a haunted house, and I remember that story.
Anybody familiar with Indiana's Monroe Demon House in Hartford City? Well, me and this guy stayed there for a night. He ended up staying on the couch all night.
So,
hold
on a second. I was not told that it was called the Demon House. I meet the owner by myself because he said we had to be there a couple hours early. So I met the owner, he gave me the keys, and he's like, by the way, like, do you know what happened with this house? Like, are you sure you're safe to be here alone? And I was like, okay, like, I'm 6'9", very big guy. Why is this short little guy telling me am I scared? You know, like, what's going on here? And he said, well, they call this place the Demon House because people get, like, possessed and pushed and scratched. And I was like, well, Justin said nothing about this Demon House crap. So the guy leaves, and I'm there in this house for 2 hours by myself. And I just thought, okay, like, this is how I'm going to die. So, legitimately, I grew up in a Southern Baptist family. Oh, one person, that's pretty cool. So, when the guy left, I was just like, okay, whoever's in this house, you can do whatever you want when people start showing up. But if you do anything while I'm here alone, we're going to have a Southern revival tonight. Seriously. And then Justin and his friends come in, and they're like, okay, we're going to start in the basement. And I was like, dude, the guy told me people are getting scratched down there. I'm not going in the basement. Justin and his friends, they go down there, and I'm just chilling up in the couch. Only one room in this house is air conditioned. Do I look like someone who does not like to be in a room with air conditioning? So as you can imagine, I stayed there. They went to the basement. One of his friends come up, and they're like, out of breath. They're like, dude, you have to go downstairs. And I was like, why? And they're like, someone got scratched. And I was like, so no, that's not happening. If there's biscuits and gravy down there, maybe. That could get me into a basement. Scratching, no, that's not happening. So we stayed there, and it was a lot of fun. And never going back. Justin would like to. I'm not going. They have dolls in every room. They have two Ouija boards. Has anyone in here ever heard a good story about a Ouija board? People, stop buying Ouija boards. Seriously, say, like, what? Never heard a good story about a Ouija board. I should also mention, I'm sure no one in here has ever heard of my podcast, but people out in Justin's podcast probably has. And so on my podcast, I produce it, so I'm not funny at all. I've been a stand-up comedian for a long time, though, so I think my listeners are going to be like, why is Shane being funny? Because I'm always serious. So we'll get into some true crime. I'll let Justin talk now, because I steal the show sometimes. But okay, we'll talk true crime.
No, I do get into the paranormal pretty heavy. I have a occult habit, so I get into that stuff pretty hard. See if there's any truth around. But is there anybody familiar? Who's local? Who's from Cincinnati area? All right. Anybody heard of a town called Fernald?
Yes.
Okay. How old are you guys? You guys old enough? Were you alive back in 1984? Okay. And I'm only looking at one person directly across the room. Have you ever heard of the death of Dave Box? Okay. Well, being from Fernald, you're probably going to be worried about this at the end of the day. Now, 20 miles northwest of Cincinnati, in a town called Fernald, there was a guy who, by the name of Dave Box, who in 1981 got a job as a pipe fitter at a place called Feed Materials Production Center. Now, this was owned at the time by the Department of Energy. Now, remember that, because that is definitely going to play a factor later on. And pretty much what happens is in June 1984, like I said, he had been hired there in 1981. In June 1984, Dave Box, I mean, working-wise, he was described as a quiet guy. He was always a very trustworthy guy and stuff like that. He had recently gone through a divorce. So just remember the fact that there is rumors of him having psychological problems, but none of these are confirmed. They're only really rumors and stuff like that, okay? So he was hired at Feed Materials Production Center, which is also known as NLO, which is the Northern Lead of Ohio. Now, the reason it's called that is we'll get into in the facts, but like I said, he was a pipe fitter. He was hired there in 1981. His basic job was to take care of maintenance and on some of the filters and some of the tanks there. Basically, NLO, which was, like I said, the Feed Materials Production Center, was a place that was owned by the government to produce high grades of uranium from the mid-50s to the mid-80s. And they would sell this uranium to the government, and it was used in weaponized nuclear warfare. Now, most of the town did not know that this was going on at the time. It didn't come out until actually a little bit later. We'll get into a little bit more about, you know, NLO and the facts and stuff like that. First, we're going to tell you what happens to Dave Box. He's working the graveyard shift. He had worked the graveyard shift since he worked there. And he goes in on Sunday at 11 p.m. And he met his ride, who was a fellow co-worker by the name of Harry Esterling. And they always used to meet at this restaurant, and then they'd go in, and they'd go to work, and then, you know, they take turns driving every other day. Well, they drive to work, and on the way to work, he's being pretty nonchalant. He's talking about his vacation with his kids that's coming up, and believe it or not, the guy was actually ranting and raving about his new lunchbox, you know, that he had bought. So that tells you a little bit about his personality and how boring this dude probably really was if he talks about his lunchbox and shit. But, so, his basic job was, he was to inspect and maintain equipment in the factory. And this was the safety pumps and the mist collectors in the uranium processing plant, which was plant number 8. And now, there were several plants on this ground. There was, we do know of at least 4, 6, and 8. So there was at least 8 of them. We do know that. And Dave was known to be that guy who would tell co-workers If there was a higher grade of uranium in one of the filters or something like that, you would be that coworker that would say, hey man, you know, this has a higher level of uranium, just be safe, be careful of what you're doing. Because it was a very known fact that these guys knew that they were secretly making uranium. And the federal government knew it, but a lot of the locals didn't. There was a lot of rumors going around in town, right? So, you know, everybody that worked there pretty much had an agreement when they started working there not to ever talk about any of the things that they were doing because of the fact that they were making this uranium in secret for the government for nuclear warfare. Now, it seems hard to believe in a small town like Fernald, you know, that this stuff was going on, but you're going to learn a lot of things about this place, the Feed Materials Production Center, that's probably going to freak you out, especially if you're from the area. So, what happens is, about midnight, Dave reports to the maintenance room for his assignment, opens up his toolbox, he leaves his keys on the toolbox with the toolbox open, he leaves his lock on top of that, and he goes to a certain area to work, which was his assigned area for the night. That would be plant number 8. So a little bit later that night, there's a big gap in the timeline, and we're not exactly sure when this happens. But Dave Box is seen by a witness in the vehicle of his supervisor. The two of them are sitting in there. And remember, this is June in the Midwest, and anybody who's from around here, which I'm sure most of you are, we all know that how humid it gets in the Midwest, even at night. And these two are seen with the windows up in a vehicle, supposedly having a very intense conversation. Now, the witness who says they saw this can't really hear what they're saying because the windows are up. Now, the reason he took note of this is because the windows were up, and it's usually humid, very, very hot at night around here. And the next time that he is seen is about an hour later. The same witness who saw him in the vehicle with his supervisor having that conversation sees Dave walking to plant 4. Now, he thought it was odd and took note of it because he had been assigned to plant 8, so he didn't know why he was heading to plant 4. Now, this would be the last time that Dave Box was ever seen alive. Now, in the morning, his friend Harry Easterly, he goes to check out. What happened is there's a safety meeting in plant 4 at 7 a.m. that following morning, and Dave doesn't show up. And his buddy Harry is like, hey, you know, tells one of the security guys, he's like, hey, you know, I gotta leave work. I'm not sure what's going on with Dave. He hasn't shown up yet. I haven't seen him in hours, and nobody has seen him in hours. So he becomes a little bit suspicious, but doesn't think too much of it. He actually thought he was working overtime. But he does notice that Dave's toolbox is still open with the keys still on top. Now, note that this is at 7 a.m. the following morning, all right? So at 7:30 a.m., the furnace operator in Plant 6 tells a supervisor that the casings on his oven are covered in a sticky residue that is having a strange odor. And the supervisor pretty much goes along and says, hey, man, nothing's going on. Get back to work. You know, nothing important. Well, the coworker ends up leaving and going home because he thought Dave was going to be working overtime or whatever. Didn't think much of it. He told the security guard, he said, hey, I'm going to go home, tell Dave what's going on. Well, a little bit later on, in 5:30 a.m. that same morning, there is a worker in Plant 6. The same guy who said that his oven smelled like a strange odor and had a sticky residue, at 5:15 he reports a 28-degree drop in one of the furnaces that he was working on. Now, the normal temperature is 1,300 degrees, so a 28-degree drop suggests some kind of foreign object in the furnace. Like I said, I mean, it was very, very peculiar, to say the least. Now, the day goes on, and at 11 o'clock that following night, or actually it'd be that same night, Harry goes to meet Dave again at that restaurant that they always meet at. And he sees his car there, and he doesn't think anything of it. And he kind of figured he was inside the restaurant, eating some food, waiting for him, or whatnot. And he goes to lean up against his car. Now, he notices the fender is cold. And then he touches the hood and notices that that is cold, too. Now, obviously, back in the 80s, they made cars to last, so they're made out of metal. If you run a car for anywhere over a half an hour amount of time, that engine and fender area is still going to be warm to the touch. So he immediately thought something was wrong. Now he gets to work, and he notices that Dave's toolbox is still open. These are still in the same spot, and this is at 11 o'clock that night. When he's starting on Monday, about 24 hours later. So he starts getting suspicious, and he tells one of the security guards to open up his locker. Now they go to his locker, and they open it up, and all of his clothes from the previous day were still in it. And that's when they start getting a little bit weird about everything. So do you want to go into some of the evidence that they end up pulling out of one of the furnaces?
No, you go ahead. Are you drunk? On the way here, we seriously talked about what parts we were talking about. I have 4 pages of notes. We're on the last part, so you go ahead.
No,
I'm just here for the looks.
We still got to go into facts.
Justin. Go on. I don't know where you're at. You lost me.
Stop.
Let's just pause for a second, because I thought of something while he was talking. So, Harry is his friend.
He even drew a fucking picture.
It looks like a male reproductive organ, doesn't it? I'm shameful of it, actually. So in the furnace, there was a few things found, and what's funny is when Justin told me that he wanted to cover this case for this, I had no idea. Like, I'm horrible with names. Like, bad. But he sent me a picture of what the guy looked like, and I was like, oh, Justin, that's so weird. When I was in college, I had a forensic science professor who was actually head of the program, and he served, he was questioned for his specific area of knowledge on this case. And I remember it because we were in lecture hall. His name was Dr. Siegel. He's dead now. But he had this huge nose with hair growing all out of it. So I like every... I know, I hope everyone's finished eating. But seriously, every lecture we had and he would talk, like, I couldn't stop staring at the nose. So everything that he told, I always took it in. And so I remember this case because he was talking about how he got asked to come there and to look through the evidence. And one of the things I remember him talking about was there was some metal that was found in his furnace along with some bones, glasses.
There was frames from his eyeglasses found in the furnace, bone fragments. There was a piece of wire that was looped 3 times, almost in a perfect triangle, that was not obviously natural made. Somebody had formed this into this tri-loop.
Yes.
And so then there was pieces of a steel-toed boot in there as well.
Yeah, so the detective asked Dr. Siegel to come and look at this. And specifically, Dr. Siegel was talking about how he was supposed to be giving his professional opinion on if that could have been used to lower someone into a furnace. Now, this is a super hot furnace. If I'm going to kill myself, I am not lowering my body into a super hot furnace. I can think of a million better ways to die. Come on now, like how stupid you gotta be. Let's lower ourselves into a furnace. Doesn't make any sense. So Dr. Siegel said that when he got there, he was just like blown away that they were even considering that this may kill himself. So he said that he looked over the wire and he said that although you cannot use that wire to lower a person that was barefoot in there just because the wire wouldn't hold your body, he specifically said that if you were wearing steel-toed boots, you could be lowered in there because then it wouldn't slip off of you. He was found with steel-toed boots in the furnace. So guess what happened, guys? He was murdered. But they're idiots, evidently. So that was one thing that Dr. Siegel told us. No one was ever charged with this because everyone's stupid, evidently. But so Harry is, so like this factory has a lot of money. Clearly, they're trying to hush him up. Let's kill him. They probably assumed that he was going to disintegrate in this fire, and it didn't happen. But the whole time, Harry, what I love about this story is Harry's like telling the truth, like, no, that supervisor's to blame. And like, no, he had his keys. Like, he is like dogging them. And I was like, we all need a good friend, Harry. Like, I seriously, like, Justin wouldn't stick up for me if it came down to it. You know, like, I want a friend, Harry.
Let him die.
Now, you can go ahead and finish.
All right, here we go. Ahead. Now, the reason it draws suspicion is because his friend Harry, when he left for work later that morning, it was about 8 o'clock a.m., still saw his keys there, and when he returned later that night, he still had the keys in the top of his toolbox. Now, the keys ended up being found in the furnace, but the keys were not burnt to the extent of the body and the other evidence, which would suggest that they were thrown in at a later date. Now, the weird thing is a little bit of some facts about this place. Feed Materials Productions, that are also known as NLO, from the mid-1950s till late 1989, secretly processed high-grade uranium for nuclear weapons during the Cold War. Now, there was low-level radiation, supposedly. Now, it's suspected that David Box had found out that they were actually processing 4 times a higher-grade uranium than they were legally allowed to by the federal government, and that he was going to blow the whistle on this. Now, this is not like conspiracy theories, because in the fall of 1984, NLO had a factory accident that released massive amounts of radioactive smoke into the air. Now, after this investigation, it was found that this place in Fernald, Ohio, had released 200 tons of radioactive dust particles into the atmosphere and into the water source. And the town freaked out. Now, this is 3 months after David Box died. So they were thinking that he was possibly going to be a whistleblower on this entire situation, because all his friends and family had given him the personality that he was just an honest, trustworthy guy. Now, don't get me wrong, there are theories that it is possible that David Box killed himself, but at the same time, you gotta think, you know, maybe he did have a tough time after his divorce. That's totally understandable. But you gotta think for a second, this guy paid all of his bills for the month. He showed up to work on a Monday. He had just got done planning a trip with his kids for the following summer. And he shows up to work, hogties himself, hooks himself up to a hoist, and lowers himself into a 1,300-degree furnace to kill himself. That's probably pretty unlikely. And, I mean, NLO, like, just those facts alone of the 200 tons, like, they shut down NLO in, I believe it was 1989. It ended up being privately owned for the last 2 years of its existence. And it's honestly cleared out now. They totally ripped the place down, and what it is now is that it's a free air reserve. So basically, they just planted a bunch of trees, a bunch of bushes, and they're basically trying to fix the fuck. You know what I'm saying? Because they're like, dude, we totally screwed these people. Like, the people of Fernald, Ohio were legitimately freaked out by this. And the fact that even up until the mid-90s, it was found that the government had suppressed and lied about cancer rates in this area around Fernald, Ohio, because of this certain situation here. So, that brings us to the question, did Dave Box get incapacitated or even shot for that matter in a plant where nobody was at and lowered into a 1,300-degree furnace? Or did he show up to work, make all these plans with his family beforehand, and including, you know, went grocery shopping for the week, paid all his bills for the month, shows up to work, decides he's going to lower himself into a 1,300-degree furnace and kill himself, you know? And I mean, the sad part about it is the Hamilton County Police Department are the ones who handled this investigation, even though the fact that it was a federally owned company up until 1987, the FBI should have been involved, but they literally, when they were approached to investigate this death, or even the fact that they had released all this toxic radiation into the atmosphere and into the water supply, they totally were like, no, we're not touching it. We don't want anything to do with it. And, I mean, that's what it comes down to, I guess. I don't know.
Let's talk about how shady this company is, okay? So, when you got hired there, they would tell you, do not tell anyone what you're doing. They would just say, give a general description, oh, I work on machines. That's shady. So, if that ever happens to anyone, don't work there.
Yeah.
But also, I mentioned having that professor, my college education is in forensic psychology. This guy killed himself. There is no way that ever happened. Like, that is so stupid. Like, come on, guys. I wrote a note down. I can't read it.
Well, I'll tell you this much. Here's a little side fact. Dave Box has never even been laid to rest by his family because his bone fragments that were found in the furnace are still so radioactive to this day that they cannot legally be buried in the ground. They were sealed up in a 55-gallon drum along with everything else that was found in this furnace, and they were shipped to New Mexico. And they are put on a shelf at a nuclear testing site. So this guy literally has still never been buried.
He was shipped to Nevada. Nevada is not in Mexico.
Yeah, you're fucking right.
Might as well be.
It's all hot desert. Isn't it?
It was Nevada. How are we on time? Are we... Okay, so
sexy. Who said that? You stop over there. I see you.
We'll end in just a second, but I have a good story. Does anyone want to hear it? Okay, so for my podcast, Out of the Shadows, I was in Memphis, Tennessee. Justin knows the story, and I should not tell it. But I get excited when I get a mic in my hand. So I was in Memphis chasing down a serial killer. Not kidding. That was fun.
That's actually what we're doing tomorrow morning.
Yeah. Thankfully, he only goes after redheads.
Any gingers?
Oh,
gingers? I see no real gingers anywhere.
They deserve it. So I was in Memphis, and while I was there, I was visiting some of the museums. So I went to Graceland, which was really cool, and I went to the Civil Rights Museum. And as I was literally walking in the door, which, like, odd things happen to me all the time, and I always feel like I'm getting pranked, like, every time. Like, it's just like, okay, what's going on? So I walk in, and as I walk in, I'm waiting in line, and I look at my phone, and I had a text message from a guy, I think his name is Alan Duke, and he said, hey Shane, I'm a producer for Nancy Grace, can you be on our show tomorrow? And I was like, okay, CNN is somewhere around here. For all of you who don't watch her show or don't keep up with, like, things that people say, and I'll give a little caveat for people out there in listen land, I do like Nancy Grace. I've met her before in person. She's nothing like, you know, she's nothing like her personality on TV. She's a very cool person.
Very nice in person.
Yeah, she is. But so what most people say about her is that, you know, she only covers cases of white young females. Whether that's true or not, I can't tell you. So I know that's like a thing. And so I was just like, someone is playing a joke. Like, I'm in the Civil Rights Museum. Like, there's CNN is around here somewhere. So I was like, okay, I'm not responding. So then a lady that I've worked with, we've met her once. She's a Netflix star on The Keepers. She's helped me with my podcast and stuff. And so she messaged me and she goes, Shane, Nancy wants us on the show tomorrow to talk about the case that they covered on the Netflix series that we also covered on my podcast. So I was like, okay, like, this is real. I'm like, okay, whatever, we'll do it. So I messaged him back, and he's like, okay, we'll just call you. Can you be on the phone at 8? And I was like, A.M.? 8 a.m.? Like, I don't do 8 a.m. Like, that's not a thing. And so I was like, fine, that's all right, whatever, I'll do it. Jenna talked me into it. Then I realized we were an hour behind. So it was going to be 7 a.m. So I set my alarm clock for 5 till. That's as good as I could give Nancy. So 5, you know, the alarm went off. I wake up, but I'm like not coherent. I'm just out of it. And so we go on the call, and so Nancy starts in. And Nancy's a very nice lady when she's not being recorded. She's like, hi, guys. You know, she's from Georgia. She has a Georgia accent. I can't do accents, or I start sounding like a German in the Hitler regime or something. It's really weird. So she's just like, hi, guys. It's so nice to hear from you again, Shane. I met you at CrimeCon last year. I look forward to meeting you again this year with you and Gemma. And I was like, oh, thanks, Nancy. She said, all right, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Stop doing that.
BFFs.
So Justin likes to say we're BFFs, which is true. No, I'm sorry. But so she's like, all right, guys, so we're going to go ahead and get started. So, okay, here we go. Baltimore. Sister Catherine says Nick found murder. Body's cold. And then all of a sudden she goes, Shane Waters, podcaster and private investigator. What can you tell me about? And then she goes on and on and on. And I just thought I was just being, I don't know what I thought she was going to ask me. So she asked me these questions, and I'm out of it. I've not had coffee. I'm useful to no one at this point. So she asked me a question, and as you can tell, I tell anyone the right answer, or whatever I think is the right answer. So I just blurt out everything I wanted to say, and then I just go on this whole spiel. You can look up her podcast and listen to it, and you'll hear me. So I didn't know what all I said, and it was finished. And then a few days later, the episode aired, and I was like, oh. And like everyone's like, what did you say? And I was like, I don't remember. I hope that I did okay, you know. So the episode airs and I'm listening to it for the first time at my house, like, come on, like, what did I say, you know? And then all of a sudden I get on there and I start comparing the Catholic Church in Baltimore to the Mafia. And I realize I just made a lot of people mad. And so, like, as I'm starting to talk about the Catholic Church in not so good terms, if you're Catholic, I'm sorry, it's true. But I start talking and dogging them, and I'm sitting there like, oh my God, Shane, shut up, like, I'm hearing it for the first time. And then all of a sudden I was like, you know what they remind me of? The Mafia. And here's like this list of reasons why. And it was all true, but I wouldn't have said it if I wasn't early drunk. Like, that's the worst. That was my funny story, guys, and I think that's our time.